First case that we will hear this morning is State versus Ibrahim. Parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Dana Nelson on behalf of the appellant Ali Ali. Mr. Stearns is here on behalf of Mr. Ibrahim. And we were going to split our time today so that I take 7 minutes and Mr. Stearns takes three. So I'm going to divide mine and take 2 minutes for rebuttal, if that's not too complicated.
I think I understand. So you're going to talk for 5 minutes right now.
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
I think I can manage that.
There are two issues in Mr. Ali's case. One is the show-up identification, and because that's a shared issue between the appellants, I'm going to let Mr. Stearns talk about that, unless this court has specific questions about my client in particular. I would plan to focus on the right to be present issue, and specifically we argue that Mr. Ali's right to be present was violated because he was never informed he had the right to come back if he behaved himself. Now, Your Honors, ordinarily what the court did here would be sufficient. The court sent defense counsel down to inform Mr. Ali that he had the right to come back if he made assurances of good behavior. The problem is that that message was not conveyed, and it's undisputed that defense counsel was unable to connect with Mr. Ali and give him that message. Now, the state's response is, why isn't that enough, what the court did? After all, it was Mr. Ali who disrupted the proceedings, and he was the one who would not talk to his attorney when his attorney came to talk to him. Our response to that is that ultimately, and the majority of the cases, Your Honor, say that that it's the court's responsibility to ensure the defendant knows of his right to return, and it's the court's responsibility to make sure that that message is conveyed to him.
What should the court have done?
Your Honor, I've thought about that, and I think that, honestly, there is going to be a line at which the court would be reasonable in saying there's nothing more the court here could do. But in this case, there were several things the court could have done. Number one, the court could have drafted an order explaining that Mr. Ali had the right to return if he behaved himself. That could possibly be passed to Mr. Ali through the jail guard. It's possible the bailiff could have been sent down with a message. And then at the outer rim, it's possible the court could have appointed a conflict attorney to go down and advise Mr. Ali of his right to return.
Were any of these proposed to the court at the time?
No, nothing like that was proposed, Your Honor. But again, it's the court's responsibility, the cases suggest, that...
Which case do you think most strongly suggests that we would reverse on this basis?
Your Honor, I think that several cases. Our case, Chapel, the court said in that circumstance it was okay for defense counsel to be the one to relay the message. But in saying that, it recognized that it's very important that the message be relayed. And the other case that I cited, I think it's Pulley, the fact that the court sent defense counsel down to relay the message wasn't sufficient because it was not on the record exactly what counsel said. And I think in, Indiana v. Allen, or the main case, the Supreme Court case.
Oh, Illinois v. Allen.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Illinois v. Allen, there I believe the court informed the defendant several times that he had the right to return. And even in the case of DeWeese, which is our jurisdiction, the defendant was told he was invited several times to return. So ultimately, it's the court's responsibility to do that. And the state also makes the argument, why should the court have to capitulate to a disruptive defendant? And again, it's true that there was possibly some manipulation going on by Mr. Ali. But in the Pulley case, the court held that that weighed even more heavily in favor of the court being the one to relay the message. And I would also point out that the right to be present is separate from the right to counsel. And it's the court's job to ensure the right to be present. And again, once the court heard that the defense counsel had not gotten the message, we would argue that there are other reasonable steps that the court could have done.
The idea that he could come back if his behavior improved was communicated to him on some occasion in the court, was it not?
No, Your Honor. The fact was that he was warned he would be taken out, and that was immediately preceding before he was taken out. The court said, if you do not stop this disruptive behavior, you're out of here. But the court never said, but if you promise to behave, you will be allowed to come back. That was never communicated. There was some talk by the sergeant. The jail guard was put under oath, and he did say that when he took Mr. Ali out, that Mr. Ali was saying he didn't want to come back to the courtroom. And I think maybe this goes to a potential harmless error argument, and I want to, if I may just take a moment of my rebuttal, argue that that should be rejected because it was not communicated to him by an officer of the court. It was a jail guard, and it was also right after he had been taken out. And it could have been sheer bravado on Mr. Ali's part. The court kicked me out. Well, I don't want to be there anyway. It's kind of like a child being told they can't have dessert. But if he had been told, if he came back to the table and behaved appropriately, like a child, he might have changed his mind. So we would argue what the detective said or what the jail guard said should not resort in this court finding harmless error. Thank you.
I think you're taking 3 minutes, am I correct?
I think so. I think that adds up properly, the math-wise. So my name is Travis Stearns, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ibrahim. I'm going to speak for my 3 minutes about the misidentification issue. Now, when Mr. Harris, who is the person who was robbed and assaulted, was sitting in the patrol car giving his statement to the police, he heard that the police had found his car and had found the people who had assaulted and robbed him. Now, rather than create a procedure after this, I think this very statement created a significant amount of taint. Rather than create procedures which would avoid that taint, the police officers did nothing other than to create a procedure which I think is very has all of the hallmarks of misidentification. Mr. Harris was not warned that the suspects, that the people that he was looking at weren't the suspects, despite the fact that he had already heard to the contrary that these were the men that were there, or that had been the men who had assaulted and robbed him. He was taken to the place where they had been arrested. The car that had been stolen from him was there. The police lights were on. Each of the suspects that were paraded in front of him were surrounded by police officers with the lights and shown in spotlights.
You cite a lot of scholarly work on the problems with misidentification. What particular case are you relying on? There's cases that say that photographic montages are impermissibly suggestive. There really aren't any cases on show-ups, are there, that say they're impermissibly suggestive?
Well, we certainly, I mean, even from the beginning of our case law through to Allen, there's a lot of worry about this procedure. And I think that probably the case that Allen is also a show-up case, and our Supreme Court was very concerned about that. And, of course, there's no lead opinion on that case, just a lot of concurrences to each other. But I think that Allen is where you can say, and I think that what Allen says is, with social science increasingly casting doubt on the reliability of identification procedures, our courts must carefully guard against misidentification. It's one of the reasons why I cited a number of the articles that they looked at, and then some other articles that have been that have come out since that point to discuss Allen and what our courts ought to be doing. It is a significant problem, especially where we have a procedure like the procedure that we have here, which really has all of the hallmarks of the taint. We see Mr. Ali does not even remotely resemble any of the men that had been identified, or in the statement doesn't identify, or he's much older, he's wearing different clothing, all of those things that we should be worried about. There were better ways to have done this. They certainly, even at the scene, they could have created better procedures. These suspects were already in the stolen car. There was no emergency. They were clearly chargeable. They were clearly people that could have been held, and a better procedure could have been created. I think that the taint of this procedure is exactly what our courts and the Supreme Court have been concerned about throughout time, and thus this should have been a suppressed identification. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Don Port, Senior Deputy Prosecutor for King County, representing the state. I'll first address Dana Nelson's concerns about Mr. Ali having been removed from the courtroom. Mr. Ali had been trying to manipulate the proceedings by having his counsel discharged repeatedly throughout the course of the trial. The judge had repeatedly denied that, and he seemed to come up with the most outlandish outburst in court to try to accomplish that. So he was removed from the courtroom after, in front of the jury, telling everyone in the courtroom that his attorney had propositioned him for sex and supplied drugs to him. So the removal, of course, was done properly without question. And then the court took a break. And on the record, the court says, I'm taking a break to read chapel. And the court was well aware of the requirements of chapel. The requirements of chapel are, frankly, guidelines, not requirements, as to help a trial court in the application of its discretion in these situations. What we know from the record is that the court put the jail guard under oath, and the jail guard gave sworn testimony that Mr. Ali had told him he would not come back to court and he would not meet with his attorney again.
Would that have meant the only pragmatic alternative would have been to drag him back up to courtroom and have the judge inform him herself?
I mean, exactly, Your Honor. Or,
and how feasible was that at the time, I guess, is the question. Because you would have had to send the jury out, kept the jury out. You would have had to, I mean, is that, is it a balancing factor? How would the trial court do that?
I think so. And I'd like you all to remember that there were two co-defendants, and the trial court had to be concerned with them getting a fair trial. And they, in fact, made motions for mistrial in this case. And they were out of session then for an hour in the middle of closing argument. And I think the only alternative, other than to capitulate and give him another attorney, would be to drag him back to court, which is frankly absurd after you've had sworn testimony from the guard that he will not come back to court.
So did this uproar occur in the middle of closing argument? Is that when it happened in the course of the trial?
Your Honor, he interrupted right at the outset of closing argument, but the content was not specific. The court stopped it immediately, removed the jury, and then outside the presence of the jury, he made this allegation against his attorney. The court said, if you interrupt the proceedings, you're going to be out of here. So they go back, and two pages of transcript into the state's closing is when he interrupted and made the same scurrilous, scandalous allegations against his attorney in front of the jury. So he's clearly
trying. You say that the co-defendants moved for mistrial on the basis of his outburst, or what was their?
Yes,
on
the basis of his outburst, prejudicing the jury toward them. And so I think that the trial court was properly concerned that if he were to be brought back, there would be further manipulations. So anyway, I think she did everything she could in this case. And, of course, the test is whether she abused her discretion under the totality of the circumstances. Now, the Chapel case cites a number of other cases. Chapel did a nice survey as to how other jurisdictions look at this issue. And one of the quotes from Chapel was from a Eighth Circuit case that was interpreting Illinois versus Allen, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and said, although it's desirable for the trial judge to assure the defendant that he or she can return later, Illinois versus Allen created no absolute requirement. And then I think an even better case for you to consider is Chapel's approval of the Minnesota case, State versus Gilliam, that was interpreting, again, Illinois versus Allen. And that indicated that the defendant has the burden to inform the court when he's ready to physically return and conform his conduct. So all I'm asking here is that under all of these circumstances, it was not an abuse of discretion to proceed with closing argument without the defendant present in court. And even if it were error, it was harmless error because the defendant had no right to be present during closing argument, no due process right. And we look at Irby for that, which I discuss in my brief, and also Thorpe. Thorpe is a Washington Court of Appeals case, and it was the only authority I could find in the state where a defendant was not present for closing argument. And the court upheld the lack of the presence because of well, both Irby and Thorpe's interpretation of the U.S. Supreme Court Snyder versus Massachusetts, where under the circumstances, the defendant's present did not really matter because his presence would have been, you know, the language from Irby, the sort of poetic stuff. The presence would have been a benefit, but a mere shadow. The presence of the defendant is a condition of due process only to the extent that a fair and just hearing would be thwarted by his absence. And what we know in this case is that even before the disruptions, Mr. Ali's attorney assured the court that he was prepared to give his closing. He'd previewed it for Mr. Ali. And so going forward under those circumstances was harmless error, if it was error at all. Now, in Ali's reply brief, counsel says that Thorpe was an anomaly and then cites four federal cases, two U.S. Supreme Court cases and two other federal cases for the proposition that closing argument is a critical stage of the proceedings. But that's a miscitation because all of those cases stand for the proposition that closing argument is a Sixth Amendment critical stage for the right to counsel. Yes, defendants have a right to have an attorney present for them at closing argument, but the defendant's presence in court is analyzed under the Confrontation Clause. And so we do have Irby and Thorpe interpreting Snyder versus Massachusetts as the authority there. So I better turn to the show-up proceedings. What I think counsel for both sides have failed to acknowledge is that show-up proceedings are different than other types of identification procedures because they are inherently suggestive. And the show-up cases all recognize this. And so the question is, was the proceeding impermissibly, unduly, unnecessarily suggestive? And those terms seem to be used interchangeably in the cases. And what we had here was, because of the circumstances of three armed men having committed a violent carjacking, when the police pulled that car over, they're going to do a high-risk felony stop. They surround the car with sufficient strength to prevent any violence from breaking out. And when they remove the three suspects from the car, they are naturally restrained in cuffs. They are separated, and enough officers remain at the scene to supply security. That's all inherent in show-up proceedings. I cited the two show-up cases that I think carry the day here, and they both address the concerns that the suspects were shown in handcuffs and with police present, and that was Fortune Zapata and Guzman Cuellar. Nothing happened here that is not an inherent part of show-ups. And I think where we have to be careful is that counsel for both sides cited other types of identification procedure cases without making it clear in the briefing that they were, frankly, other types of identification proceedings. And there are many examples of this. One of them that they both rely on is the McDonald case. And they cite that for the proposition that in McDonald, a conviction was reversed because an officer provided information to the witness in an identification procedure. And that's how it's phrased in one of the briefs. They don't tell you that it was a lineup procedure, and they don't tell you what information was provided. That was a lineup in which the witness identified the wrong person in the lineup, and the detective told him who the correct suspect was. And then they altered the identification testimony to say that the witness had made a tentative identification of the correct suspect along with the wrong guy.
I think I heard perhaps a suggestion here that from counsel that it wasn't an emergency, so why have a show up at all? Why not arrest the guys, you know, take them back to the police station or someplace else and do something a little bit less inherently suggestive?
And really, that's just a policy determination that has been made in our jurisprudence about show-ups. What we say is that in the immediate aftermath of a crime, when the officers are actively pursuing suspects, and if they take suspects into custody, there's benefit by doing an immediate procedure because it tends to limit wrongful arrests. And so that's how I would respond to that. There's no requirement to do more.
Is there a case that says just what you got through saying? line has been drawn and that it is helpful to do it that way.
Yeah, and I don't remember if it's Fortune Zapata.
One of those.
Or Guzman Cuellar referring to the federal cases.
Okay.
All right. There's much more I'd like to say, but
right,
you know, at that time, I'd like to go into specifics about the identifications. But thank you very much.
Thank you. So you have maybe a little more than a minute.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. A couple comments about the show up, and then I'd like to return to the right to be present. Regarding the McDonald case, we analogize to that because in that case, the officer made suggestive comments to the witness that resulted in an unreliable identification. And we argue that that's what happened here when the officer Bartolo made suggestive comments to Mr. Harris before the show up ID. So that's why we analogize to that. And in addition to that, there were also at the show up ID a high number of officers that there is case law out there suggesting that that also makes it highly suggestive. Returning to the right to be present, there were less restrictive alternatives to a drag order that could have been tried here. Again, the bailiff could have delivered the message. The court itself could have drafted an order. And also, I do not believe that the Chapel Court approved of the Minnesota decision that counsel has cited, where that court held that it's the defendant's obligation to say he's ready to return. Chapel stands directly contrary to that because it held in that case it was sufficient that defense counsel delivered the message, which implies that somebody must deliver the message. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Our next case this morning, State versus Hood.